Buying secondhand can mean different things to all of us. For some, it's a necessity to bag a bargain. For others, it might be discovering a curiosity or creating an aesthetic, feeding an obsession. But when you peer through the windows of your local op shop, what do you see? And I'd love to hear from you today. What's the most cherished item you found buried in an op shop? You can leave your stories on Facebook and check out some of the others while you're there. Just search for RN Life Matters. Robin Anear is a self-confessed op shopper and author. Her new book is called Nothing New, A History of Secondhand. Robin, welcome to Life Matters.
Hi, Michael.
Good to have you with us. Do you have a secondhand item that you cherish above all others?
Above all others, that's a big call. I have a koala I found in the takeaway for free trolley at the front of our local op shop. There had been a whole suite of these koalas. Somebody had obviously collected and cherished them, and I suspect had passed away. And they were for sale over many weeks in the op shop. There must have been 20 or more. This was the last of them. Nobody wanted it. It was in the takeaway for free. It was one of those children's toys that has its nose almost rubbed off, the fur rubbed off the ears and the ends of the toes. And it was just, you know, I wanted the love to keep on flowing to this koala. So I gave it a home.
And is it still with you?
Yeah. Yeah, my granddaughters love it now.
Oh, that's fantastic. And I take it if your granddaughters have it, it's got a name.
No, it doesn't. It's just
really?
Koala.
Just koala. Well, it's just quite koala. Literal, quite concrete.
Yeah.
When you were younger, didn't you find a box in an op shop and lift the lid and find something?
The lid lifted itself, actually. It was at my favourite op shop. It was in a church hall with stuff completely unsorted. It wasn't one of these where everything's priced and neatly racked. And you had to ferret around under benches and so on. And I was doing just that one day. And there was a sort of leatherette trunk under the bench with quite a bit of stuff heaped on top of it. I moved that stuff and the lid rose of its own accord. And yes, and what rose was a head, and it was the head of a resuscitation dummy, head and chest only, rubber, with sort of rubber flesh-coloured hair waved in a various fetching 1930s kind of aesthetic. And it had a two removable nose and mouth, so you could resuscitate one while the other was boiling and being decontaminated. And so I dressed it up in, I gave him the name Lionel, and dressed it up in a dinner shirt and bow tie, and he would be the chaperone at many a party in my share houses over the next 10 years or so during my 20s.
Oh, do give our love to Lionel.
No, he's gone.
Oh, what happened? Did you break up?
No, I think I moved house once too many times, and who knows? I don't know.
Well, I hope Lionel's found a new home. I hope he's all right.
So do I. Yeah. Yeah, I hope he's loved.
Now, look, in investigating and researching for this book, we should define some terms. When you look at the term secondhand goods in a dictionary, what comes back?
You've caught me on the hop. What comes back? All sorts of things that suggest second best, really.
Oh. Yeah. So there's a stigma there.
Oh, yeah. Well, traditionally, and I think in a dictionary sense, yes, but look, this is changing. The stigma arose in the 19th century, and it took the best part of 100 years, I think, for it to wear off, so that it wasn't until the 1960s when youth culture arose and everybody wanted to shock their parents, I guess, that the stigma really began to flip on its head.
The rise of shabby chic.
Exactly. And it was usually wearing something that would, in its original life, have been very posh, like a uniform or perhaps a starched Edwardian petticoat. Well, no, I don't think it would have been starched, but, you know, a very flash Edwardian petticoat. But, you know, you would be wearing it with bare feet and uncombed hair and, you know, a joint at the other end of your arm.
I get it. So, look, we'll talk some more about the rise of op shop or op shopping as a way of expressing some kind of rebellion to the previous generation. More on that soon. But we call them op shops. What are they called in America?
America, thrift shops. And in the UK, charity shops. So opportunity shops, which of course is what Op Shops is short for, is a great spin on the idea. And you can see it's much more attractive. There isn't the kind of stigma of poverty or need or penny pinching attached to it. It really opens a sense of possibility, which is the thing that I love most about Op Shops. So the name gives that to you, I think, and must have encouraged their flourishing, I reckon, in Australia.
And Robin, if we look at their wider history, where did they have their beginnings around the globe?
Good question. I think London and in the US, they arose at the end of the 19th century when the giving away of clothing to the needy as charity, there was a huge stigma at the receiving end of that after not too many decades of that actually being a tradition, giving away clothing as charity. There was no dignity attached to it. And so the op shop was seen as a way, or the charity shop was seen as a way of giving some agency to the people who did need inexpensive clothing and other things, but everybody was invited to buy, and they were just another consumer. So it was a way of them joining the consumer society, having some dignity and getting the cheap stuff they needed. But the other part of that equation was the big charities like Goodwill in the US, the Salvation Army in Britain and then here, also gave work to people in elevators, in organisations they called elevators, where they were elevating people in society.
Really?
By involving them in the collection of the secondhand goods, the rejuvenation of them and sorting, and then the selling of them. And they would house the people as well. And in this way, they would also become, useful and valued members of society and part of the whole consumer mechanism as well.
I find that sort of whole industry built up around the history of op shops, or whatever you like to call them, incredibly interesting. And also, we have to remember the involvement, because so many op shops are still renowned for clothing. We have to look at the historical connections there to what's often called the rag trade, the clothing industry. And Petticoat Lane in the UK, would that have been playing a role in all of that?
Yeah, Petticoat Lane in the early part of the 19th century, right up until the mid-century and beyond, was the epicenter, really, in the world for rags and secondhand clothes. And it was an amazingly thriving industry. The collecting of it from people's homes, people, rag and bone men, going around the streets crying for secondhand clothes, not literally weeping, but crying out, "Old clo, old clo," and they were the collectors. And people would bring their old clo out and either get a little bit of money for them, or they might swap them for items of china or even goldfish.
Goldfish.
And that was happening up, right up until the 1950s. I have met a woman who gave some rags in exchange for goldfish. So this would happen. Then those clothes would be taken to the old clothes exchange, where they'd be sold to the middlemen who would sell them at stalls and so on. But they'd often be clobbered, that is, rejuvenated or remade or altered in some way.
Is that where we got the word clobber? Is that where the Australians got the word clobber for clothing?
Yeah, exactly. That's it. Yes, you see the origins of lots of things in this stuff. Clobbering and, many, many fabulous words have sprung out of my book that I didn't know before.
Well, op shops or charity shops or, even rummage sales aren't just clothing. They've also been associated with furniture and bric-a-brac as well. When it comes to furniture, when did they start making their presence felt in what we now call an op shop?
I think, again, around the early 19th century, waste product depots or bureaus were started by St. Vincent de Paul and the Red Cross. That was certainly in Australia. And in the US and UK also, this stuff would be collected from people's homes and taken to a central depot and, redistributed very cheaply. So that was happening then. And then there was the White Elephant Sale, where a lot of curios and bigger stuff like furniture would be rehoused, but that happened through the jumble sale kind of context. And the White Elephant stall arose just before the First World War, and really within a very few years the people running White Elephant stores were sick of the whole idea because, you know, there was no op shop in those days where you could take it and dump it at the end of the jumble sale. You were always left with, you know, these mounted boar's heads and God knows what that you couldn't find a home for. So they ended up offering them as raffle prizes. Just imagine being the lucky winner of that.
And now, of course, we have garage sales and then we take what's remainder that no one else wants to buy to the op shop in the hope that someone else will get some benefit from it.
Yeah. And, you know, it usually works. I know some of the stuff that finds its way to op shops on a Saturday afternoon is really past it and ends up at the tip. But so much of it is gleefully grabbed by people on Monday morning.
Robin, looking back over the history of this kind of behaviour, what role did pawnbrokers play in all of this?
They played a vital role. Going back through history, you know, in the mists of time, as they say. They were virtually like a working people's or poor people's bank, so that you might have, well, women probably had two dresses if they were lucky, and one of those dresses may well be taken to the pawnbroker at the beginning of the week and be reclaimed on a Saturday, which was payday, where you'd have the money to pay the small amount of interest.
Just in time for church.
The money. well as the money that you'd been lent on it. And so that money, they'd be used to deposit regularly, or there might be a precious heirloom, just a piece of china or something of that sort that you would take in regularly, or a warm winter coat that would be taken in every summer and left for the duration of the summer so that perhaps you could buy, in the springtime, things would be pawned to buy seed to lay a crop, and then they'd be redeemed at the end of the season if you were lucky.
That's amazing.
Things of that sort, yeah. And of course, things that couldn't be redeemed, that people couldn't pay back the money on, would find their way into a sale, into an auction of unredeemed goods, and then would become part of the whole secondhand market.
You're listening to Life Matters. I'm Michael McKenzie, and I'm speaking with Robin Anear, self-confessed op shopper, historian, and author of Nothing New, A History of Secondhand. And we'd love to hear from you today as well. What are some of your most cherished items you found buried in an op shop or a jumble sale or a White Elephant sale or a garage sale? What did you discover? You can leave your comments and photographs, as people have already done, on our Facebook page. Just search for RN Life Matters and like us while you're there. Robin, when did the first op shop officially open in Australia?
It was in Melbourne in 1925, and it was an elaboration on the usual jumble sale, which was a great way of raising money for whatever. On this occasion, it was raising money for a new wing for the St. Vincent's Hospital, and Lady Millie Tallis, who was just back from a motoring tour of Europe and America with her husband, was on the fundraising committee as one of the worthies of the town, and she said, why don't we have an opportunity shop? She came up with the idea of the name because she'd seen the Magasin d'Occasion in France, and occasion can translate either as bargain or as opportunity, and she, being a canny marketer, went for opportunity. And the building, the empty building that was on the site of the proposed X-ray wing of the hospital, was utilised for 3 or 4 months. Every day it was open as Melbourne's first opportunity shop, and it was just thronged from the start.
In fact, there had to be crowd control.
That did, and that was a common theme in Melbourne, Sydney and elsewhere in those early opportunity shop times, that the shops often were tiny. They were sometimes only open once a week or once a month. On those days, people were so keen to get their hands on the stuff, the police would have to mind the crowd so that not too many squeezed in at once.
And then, of course, as time moves on, we've seen op shops being a treasure trove for the next generation, as we mentioned earlier, where people go to find what we call, in some ways, shabby chic. It's a way of saying, I am different to the rest of mainstream Australia or wherever you may live. I'm taking some of the clothes of yesteryear and repurposing them for my own self-image.
Yeah. Clothes and curios. There's sentimentality involved. You know, you see things that remind you of things your grandmother had, and you want to have that in your own kitchen or in your own life and perpetuate it. Or there's the kitsch kind of factor that you like to bring that aesthetic to your home and to your life. And there's just that thing of clothes-wise or whatever, it enables you to be playful in a way that is not so easy with the newly manufactured goods. It's more expensive to be playful, but also, you know, somebody else is pitching the things to you, and you really have to go into an op shop and just see what's there on the day and see what possibilities it offers you. And there's something really creative and imaginative in that undertaking.
It's treasure hunting. It's sheer treasure hunting. That's what it is.
That is one aspect, Michael.
Robin is with us, and also joining us today is someone from this generation that's now going op shopping with glee and for sometimes different reasons. Hannah Close is an op shop blogger and founder of Never Pay Retail. Hannah's self-slogan is, "We should all be thrifters." Hello, Hannah.
Hey, Michael. How's it going?
I'm well. She's with us on Skype. Hannah, have you always been an op shopper?
Yeah, you could say I've been thrifting since birth, and I blame my parents entirely for that. They would take me to the rubbish tip even, not just the op shop, but the rubbish tip to find things. And I tell you, back then, the smell was awful. And I remember just zipping up my jacket over my nose and going, oh my goodness, what are we doing here? But I mean, honestly, we found amazing pieces even at the tip.
So I guess share us one. You've got to tell us one.
Oh, well, my parents found a dining table for $1 and they restored it. So they sanded it and lacquered it. And we still have the same table to this day. So without giving my age away, it's over 30 years old. Been in our house for over 30 years and it's beautiful. That's
fantastic.
Even know it's from the tip.
Well, even if you can't tell, I would still tell, so that people know how good you are at finding a bargain. Do you still op shop these days for economic reasons?
Well, definitely. I mean, obviously there is a cost benefit, but for me, it's so much more than that. You know, obviously you're helping charity, so there's no regrets when you buy something, you know, because at the end of the day, you're donating to charity, you're helping someone in need. So there's that feel good factor. And obviously it's preventing clothing from landing in landfill. So, you know, 6,000 tons go there every 10 minutes here in Australia. So we've got to do something about it. So there's a lot of different factors that make it so appealing to me.
Oh, 6,000 tons every 10 minutes. That's extraordinary. I would have thought we were doing better than that. But yes, recycling what we've already made, whether it be clothing or bric-a-brac or furniture, is surely great for so many parts of our environment and also our economy. You do things called thriftovers. What's a thriftover?
Yeah, so some people find op shops a little bit overwhelming. They can never find anything. So basically, and some people really do want to have sustainable style, but they just don't know where to start. So, you know, for newbies, I'll take them thrifting and help them create a new in quotation marks, wardrobe out of secondhand clothing and help them find some gems in amongst all of the array of clothing, and teach them some tips and tricks on what to look for, where to find it, how to thrift, you know. And I mean, I do the legwork and the arm work for them. I mean, my right bicep is very strong from all the rummaging.
so you've got rummaging muscles.
Oh, mate, I don't need a gym membership. I just op shop.
Do you think the vintage trend where you find and salvage clothing particularly that, and maybe hats and other bits of accoutrement, is where you can see value because it's been well made from a well-designed and well-thought-of fashion house. Do you think that's adding value, or is it creating a second-tier kind of economy which excludes some people from affordable clothing?
Well, that's a really good question. I mean, for me, I find so much vintage for really reasonable prices. So I don't think it's pricing me out of the market, so to speak.
Oh, that's good to know. Great.
Yeah, no. And to be honest, it's great to find those vintage pieces in the op shops because obviously they are well made. They were made in Australia, which is also great. I always love finding things made in Australia. And yeah, you'd be surprised what you can find for around $3 that's vintage and quality. I'm excited.
See, when you say things like $3 and still exciting, oh, that's brilliant. Robin, we're running out of time, and I just wanted to ask you, do you see that op shops will always have a role in Australian society and the economy?
I do, yeah. I think it's just going to grow. Yes, especially as people become more aware of the reuse and recycle and repurpose, that's going to become a bigger and bigger part of our scene. Yep, they're here to stay.
I'd like to thank Robin Anear, author of Nothing New, A History of Secondhand, and Hannah Close, op shop blogger and founder of Never Pay Retail.